Please help me to welcome our speaker tonight is Adrian C. from the Atlantic Group in New York.
How you doing, everybody? My name is Adrian Clark. I am an alcoholic. Good to be here. Did you turn this off last time? No? Oh, you keep it? Okay, cool. That's fine. Good to be here. Absolute honor, privilege to be asked out to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, but, you know, an eight-year group anniversary. And I got to say, and I'm not just saying this because I'm here and you're here, that this is, I've been to a lot of AA meetings in my life, and this is my favorite meeting, you know. And I'll tell you, I'm big on energy. I really am. And the first time I came to this meeting and walked through the door, it was a couple of years ago to come here. I just loved it and the people and everything. And I kind of felt that hospitable feeling tonight again. And what's funny is this is actually my sponsor's favorite group to speak at also. And he sends his love tonight. So to be asked here to come and speak tonight, to do my speaking is my least favorite thing that I like to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I'll drive, you know, I'll wreck a Christmas party, wreck a family christening, you know, not bat an eyelid, drive a car into a field full of knackers and a blackout and get out and walk away, not bat an eyelid, but heaven forbid, speak in front of a room full of drunks, you know. It just makes me nervous, you know. And I think it's because you know me better than I know me. You know, you can kind of BS all the other people, but can't really BS you guys, you know, because you're the biggest BSers on the planet, right? I know. But, you know, I'm feeling tired because I was working today, but I'm feeling really good, you know. At the minute, I've hit a place where I think my recovery has been peaks and valleys, you know, ups and downs. And at the beginning, it's like, boom, up and down and up and down. And I feel like I've really hit a place at the minute where I just came through another set of steps. I've been sober from February 18th, 2001, and I've worked with this process out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous from pretty much my second week in Alcoholics Anonymous this time, because I was a relapser who, you know, hopped in and out and told all the lies and, you know, would leave meetings and go and get drunk and would get drunk and come to meetings. And, you know, anybody who's done that, I mean, I used to love coming to a meeting drunk, and they were the nights that I wanted to share, you know. I always had good stuff to say, you know. Alcohol gives you access to some really good material, doesn't it? And you're the only one that thinks so, right? You know, and I'd done all that. You know, if there's anybody new here tonight that is back from a relapse or a slip or whatever, I'm with you, I get it. It's tough to walk back in here. You know, there's a lot of shame and guilt, which is unnecessary, but that's what we carry with us, is shame and guilt, you know. And I hope you can get something that maybe you spoke to someone before the meeting, or maybe you can pick something up from here tonight, or even a phone number or whatever that'll bring you back to your next meeting. Because there's absolutely no shame in relapsing and coming back here. It's not part of recovery, I've found. You don't have to, you know. Being a student of this book and meeting people along this path have taught me that it's important to tell someone your sobriety did. And it's important to let new people know that you never have to drink in your life again. That's what we got going on here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You never have to put a sip of alcohol near your lips for the rest of your life again. Many of us will do it. You know, I got a phone call from a really good friend of mine. You know, this is an anniversary, and I don't want to doom and gloom, but I'm gonna say this off the bat, and then hopefully we're going to get a little more positive after that. I got a phone call from a guy last Tuesday when I was on my way to my home group, and this guy was kind of like a hero to me in Alcoholics Anonymous when I first came around. He, you know, helped me with the big book, and he was a very charismatic big book talker, and he traveled around the world, and he'd done workshops, and, you know, and he called me last Tuesday because I hadn't seen him for a long time. He'd 20 years, and he went back drinking again. And that doesn't shock me or surprise me because I hear those stories all the time. That's what we do. We go back drinking again. And but it does kind of shake you up a little bit. And I asked him, you know, what happened, man? And he talked me through it. You know, and someone who was very active in Alcoholics Anonymous, who sponsored a lot of people, who helped a lot of people. And he says, it's as simple as this, Adrian. I stopped doing all three sides of that AA triangle. And you don't stop doing it all at once. You stop doing it bit by bit. And he told me how he stopped taking one phone call at a time. stopped making one phone call at a time. You know, backed away from any accountability in his life. Then the praying goes and the meditation goes, and I've watched people with top shelf programs go back drinking again, because that's the nature of this illness. So I'm really grateful to be standing up here tonight sober. I really am. The further I walk down this path, the more people we seem to lose, the more grateful I become, the more it's a propellant for me to really want to get up and do this again. And I come through another set of steps, sir. And I'll tell you, anytime I've visited this process, and I have done quite a few times with different people, I'll do that every once in a while. I have my sponsor, but, you know, if I hear something at a conference or a workshop or something where there's a guy, you know, that I'm attracted to something that he said, I'll talk to him and I'll get his number and we'll talk. And that's what happened with this guy that lived out in Iowa. And I wasn't even planning on asking him to bring me through the steps. And I come off that phone that night, starting embarking another journey through these 12 steps, and it was just as tough as the first one I ever went through. Because you see, I have this thing inside my mind. I don't know, they call it an ego or something. It just seems to always be there, you know? It's always there. And, you know, it always seems to get louder and louder and louder when I'm going to do something good, you know? And that's what happened again. And, you know, it wakens up, and I'll tell you guys, there's never been a time where I've worked those 12 steps where I come through the other side of it and said, damn, I didn't need to do that. I just didn't need to do that there, you know? Those 20 hidden resentments that I didn't see. You know, my life is just not better without them. I want them back. You know, give me them. Those fears that have been resolved and fell away that I didn't even know that I had, give me them back. That hasn't happened once. It really hasn't. But there's something that happens to people like me, and I watch it all the time, where you meet guys and they're like, can you take me through this work? And they'll make one phone call or two phone calls or three, and then they disappear again. I mean, that's what we're up against here. I come from where alcoholism was invented, you know? And I'm kind of proud of that in a sick way, you know? You know, the Germans are famous for their kind of building motor cars, and, you know, the Italians are famous for their food, and, you know, the Irish were famous for freaking drinking. We had some good writers and playwrights, but they were actually drunks as well, you know? So we're drunks. I come from far away from here. And, you know, I was thinking when I was sitting there tonight, I see a lot of young people here tonight. And I was speaking to that gentleman before the meeting there. He's 19 and he's here. And I'll tell you, I'm not one of these guys that says, you know, I spilled more drink in my tie than you, kid, because I've heard people say that. If you've got alcoholism, you've got alcoholism. At which point do you, you know, draw the line in the sand and say enough's enough? Because I've always seen alcoholism like, it's like a big tree, like the alcoholism tree, you know? And you start at the top of it, and you just start falling. And you start to hit every root and branch on the way down. And you can decide to get off whenever you want. You know, some of us get off when we're 19 because maybe we hit someone with a car and a blackout, and some of us have to go to prison and do 10 years and 20 years, and some of us just don't get off at all. I have people in my family that have been falling and falling and falling, and that's a long fall, and it never seems the end. Mine ended when I was 26. I got off, and I said, you know what, I've had enough. I can't take any more of this. I can't do another day of being me. I can't do another day of the lying, the cheating, the stealing, and the internal pain that was going on inside of me. Because I have alcoholism. I really do. And, you know, I look back over my life, guys, and I've had problems from the beginning. I think there was a period of the first 4 years of my life. I hear people say a lot, you know, from as far back as I can remember, my thinking was crazy. And that wasn't my experience. I remember being the youngest of a family and having a lot of love in my house. And I remember being connected to something. I remember being connected to some kind of power. Some kind of powerful thing. There was like light in my life for about the first 4 or 5 years of it. And then after that, when I started going out to the outside world, when people started to tell me about God, is when it seemed to start to go wrong. When I didn't have a word for God and I didn't know what God was, I seemed to be connected to this thing that was working quite well. And then everyone else started to kind of try to, no, you got to force me this way and force me that way. And things started to go wrong. And I started to, I started to have this obsession, this peculiar obsession with alcohol from I was about 6 years of age. Because I noticed that I lived in a place called Belfast in the north of Ireland, and it was a tightly wound place. There was a war going on. And I can remember when I started to go out with my mom and stuff when I was a kid on the streets, you'd see these British soldiers with their faces painted black, and they'd have like these camouflage fatigue suits on, and they'd be in tanks, and the place would be on fire, and there'd be these other guys would be shooting at them, and you'd be told you can't go to that part of Belfast because they're Protestant, and if you go over there, they'll kill you because of your religion, because they believe in God in a different way from us. And I had all this stuff coming on. I needed a six-pack by the time I left nursery school, you know? I mean, I'm like, can somebody get me a drink here, like, you know? And all this stuff's going on, and I got to tell you, I'm afraid, you know? I started to develop these fears that I never had, that I remember a time when I didn't have them. And I started to develop these fears. And I developed these fears when I went to the Christian Brothers school. And I just started to become afraid of everything. I really did. And what I noticed was that, you know, I had a big family. I had a lot of aunts, I had a lot of uncles and stuff. And everybody seemed to be on edge all the time. They were worried about this, worried about that. But what I noticed early on was when there was alcohol in the company, or there was a party, or there was alcohol going on, everybody seemed to be happy. Everybody seemed to, it was a mood changer. I knew that from the beginning, and I took a mental note of that. And I had an obsession with alcohol from I was 6 years of age. First time I took a hit from alcohol was when I was probably 7 or 8 years of age in a vineyard in Salou in Portugal, when I was there on vacation with my family. And everybody's getting a tour around the vineyard, and you know, I see these glass. I'm not worried about the beautiful part of Portugal we're in. All I'm zooming in on is these big glasses of golden wine sitting on this table. And I'm thinking, when they're not looking, I'm going to have a go at this. I'm going to see what's making these people happy. And I remember when they turn their back, I'd be like, bloof. And I remember feeling dizzy and boom, walking into the wall and thinking, whoa, it doesn't seem all that good. And I remember at 6 or 7 or 8 years of age quitting drinking. I thought, you know, I'm going to stay away from this. This is not for me, you know. My little bike still has the training wheels on it. I'm like, you know, I'm not gonna do this. And I can remember that scaring me for a while and thinking, that's probably not the way to go. But when you're a 6-year-old kid and you're obsessing over alcohol, that's a problem. You got nothing to compare it with or anything. You got your little mind, your little ego back then, and it's just, you know, you're all over the place. You're watching all this stuff going on. And I used to watch the tough guys on the street corner, because that's what we done. I grew up drinking on the streets of Belfast, because that's what you do back in Ireland. You drink on the streets. It's no big deal or whatever. I mean, my parents didn't approve of it, but I just ignored them and done it anyway. We'd go to the liquor store, we'd get bottles of cider, these big bottles of old English cider, and we'd stand on the street and drink them. It was a subculture back there. I think we have just a bigger problem with alcoholism in America. It's just disguised better. So it is, you know. It really is. I mean, I meet kids all the time in detoxes, 18, 19. I spoke to a guy recently, done his first detox when he was 11. You know? So age is not a factor in this. And, you know, if I look at the progression of my alcoholism, again, my next collision with alcoholism was a party at Christmas, and they just looked like they were having so much fun in my house. They really did. Everybody was dancing, everybody was singing, and I thought, you know what, let me have another shot at this. You know, and I'd done some minesweeping. Any minesweepers in here? You know what minesweeping is, when you steal everybody's booze on them when they're not watching? You know? And I'm lifting a tin from Uncle Sean, a can of beer from Uncle Sean, and, you know, a can from Uncle Danny. And, you know, I'm getting them together one by one and putting them in my pocket and hiding. And I went up to the attic of my mom's house, and I sat down, and I started bashing them into me. Because, you know what, I didn't know it back then, but there was stuff going on inside of me that I just needed to escape from. My ego was already going 100 miles an hour. It really was. My mind was already chewing me up. I just wasn't happy with me. I was uncomfortable with me, you know? And I'm at that age in my life, that awkward age from like 11 to 18, where it's just like, they were tough years for me. They really were. And I remember waking up the next morning with those empty cans beside me and thinking, poof, I don't want to do this. This is not good. I really don't. And then by the time I was 15, guys, I'd started drinking, you know? My alcoholism had really kicked in. I think I drank alcoholically from the start. I mean, I didn't start drinking every day. I never ended up with a long trench coat on, drinking out of a bottle on the street with a bagger on it with an old dirty hat on. That wasn't me. But I drank alcoholically from the beginning. What I mean by that is the first night I really had my first pop from alcohol, I can remember it. I can remember it well, guys. I cannot remember the first night I had sex. And that's how much of an effect that alcohol had. And believe me, don't get me wrong, I like having sex. You know, I do. You know, it's funny because, you know, some people like to dance when they're drinking, you know. Some people like to make love, you know. Some people like to go out and eat dinner and stuff. I like to fight, you know. That was my thing. I'm Irish, I like to fight. But, you know, if you get a fight and make love, maybe throw some Chinese food in there. And a dance. That's a good night, right? See if you get all four together. That's what we call a party in Belfast. So it is, you know. And off I went, you know. And I think somewhere around that part of my life, guys, I give myself a license to do whatever I wanted to do. And I developed a coldness and, you know, not very many emotions involved, where I just started stormtrooping through my life and everybody else's life. And I'll tell you, I came from a good family. I come from good stock. I come from good people. My father had a really good job. My mother was a stay-at-home mom who raised us. We lived in a really nice house in Belfast. We had a second home in a different part of Ireland. We went on a family vacation to Europe every year. I mean, we were better off than most people in Belfast. So if anybody had a reason not to drink, it was me. If anybody had a reason to behave themselves and do well, it was me. And my family had really, really great expectations on my head. They really wanted me to do stuff. I got a scholarship out of college to go and be a soccer player. And I'll tell you guys, that's the only thing that I was ever passionate about in my whole life, was soccer. And looking back, guys, the reason for that being was it was a place to escape. It was a place to escape from the troubles. It was a place to escape from school. And I played it from sun up to sundown, on the streets, all around the place. I played for a team, and one of the proudest moments in my life was one of the big soccer franchises called my house when I was at school and wanted me to come over for a tryout. And shortly after that, I had a really bad break. I had a really bad accident, and I'll tell you, I was mad at God. I'd been mad at God for quite a few years, but I was really mad at him now, because he'd taken away from me the thing that I... And you know what, guys? See, when I look back, it's almost like I took these 12 steps in reverse in my life. My parents taught me these principles. My mom taught me the difference between right and wrong, sitting on her knee. At that time, my ankle snapped, guys. I took the third step in reverse, and I started going off in a different direction. And my life started to change, and the booze started to become more prevalent. By the time I was 18, I was a daily drinker, guys, and I didn't even know it until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because there seems to be this delusion, this lie around your drinking, where you always make an excuse for drinking, right? So it doesn't matter, I'm an 18-year-old guy. You know, my soccer career's kind of went down the tubes. I'm young, I'm having fun, right? So that's kind of, you can drink every day. And alongside that, if you're going to be a daily drinker, you better have the money to do it, you know? And when you don't have a job, you got to find other ways to do it, right? And what started to happen was, guys, I started to fall on the scrap heap of life, one dead-end job after another. Started to resort to crime in around where my parents lived. I'd done some shameful things. Nearly all of it's been cleaned up. All that stuff's been cleaned up where I started to break into people's houses. In the estate that I lived in, I knew who all the drinkers were. I knew where their liquor cabinet was. I knew who had beer in the refrigerator. And I started to break into people's houses. You know, and some of the guys that I would do that with, you know, they'd be in people's drawers, taking the jewelry, they'd be taking this, they'd be taking that. I'd be straight into the refrigerator, guys, in the liquor cabinet. I wasn't really too concerned about the money. I just wanted to get drunk. Because I'll tell you guys, see, when I drink alcohol, like our book talks about, it creates an effect in me that's really hard to explain. It just takes me away from everybody and everything, and I feel good. And I'm willing to pay the price to have that in that moment. And I'm willing to waken up the next day, guys, and be arrested. I'm willing to waken up the next day and go to whatever it is. In that moment, I'm willing to pay the price so I can just get high from alcohol. And I knew that early on. I really did. By the time I wasn't even out of my teens yet, guys, and I knew where every early house was in Belfast. I started to appear at those. Lana outside them at 5 o'clock in the morning, 4 a.m. in the morning, waiting for them to open, just so I could go in and get a fix, guys. Just so I could go in and stop the shakes. Because that's what started to happen, you know? These early houses, guys, I'm telling you, they searched you for a weapon on the way in, and if you didn't have one, they'd give you one. You know? Some of these places didn't have windows in them, and that's not the way I was brought up, you know? And my parents started to notice the things that I was doing. My family started. And, you know, I had a good family that tried to divert me from this, tried to get me jobs, got me good jobs. Like my brother-in-law was a CEO, general manager for a really, really, really great corporation back in Ireland, and he got me a job in that. I showed up on the first day drunk with a really bad hangover and turned and walked straight back out again. Didn't even do it. Give me a second bite at the cherry, got me back in there again. They fired me again. Every job I had before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, people had to tell me, listen, you can't work here, you gotta go. The longest periods of jobs that I had was working for other alcoholics, you know? And I started to develop the old, you know, show up Tuesday, go drinking again Thursday, and became a binge drinker, and my life just became unmanageable, guys. And I started to see that early on, that I just couldn't manage my own life. I started coming home in bad shapes, guys. Alcohol had an effect on me. It's funny how it works because, you know, it's like my ego is like a pendulum back then. It really was. One day it would be down in the cellar, like the Grim Reaper going, the poor me, da-da-da-da-da, you know. And then the next day it would have the Superman suit on, be up through the roof, sitting on the roof, the great I am. You know, that's how my life looked like. That's what went on inside my mind. See, when I poured alcohol on top of that, guys, you had a dangerous person on your hands. And that's what I became, a dangerous person. I remember coming home, guys, when I was 19, 20 years of age. And I really can't remember this happening, but my father told me about it. And I was in such a bad shape, so sick from alcohol and drugs, that I remember coming in and my father getting up. I was making so much noise. And I put my head through the window. And I remember he was trying to put me into bed to calm me down because I was shaking. And I remember this part of it here. I'll never forget it, guys. And I think it was my first experience with the DTs. I remember a 30-foot snake being in the bed with me, wrapping itself around me. And I'm screaming in convulsions. And I remember my father getting up the next morning and asking me, did I remember any of it last night? And I'm lying in a bed of sweat, guys, and I'm not doing well. And he said, I'm bringing you to the doctors. Now, you got to understand back then, no one really knows anything about alcoholism in Ireland, you know? They really don't. I'd never heard of a detox or a rehab or anything until I came to New York. You know, maybe seen it on a movie or whatever. I wasn't too interested in it. So there was really nowhere to go. And on top of that, I didn't know what my problem was. I didn't know I was alcoholic. Even when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous this time, I didn't know I was alcoholic. I had to be 12-stepped into that. So if you're not sure if you're alcoholic or not, that's okay. That's fine, you know? And I remember my father bringing me to my first outpatient program. He brought me to the doctor the next day. And that started a round of doctors, guys, psychiatrists. I was on a search to find out what was wrong with me. But the common denominator was, guys, I couldn't stop drinking. I really couldn't stop drinking. And it just got uglier and uglier. And, you know, I started to create a little bit of a reputation for myself around the area that I lived in. And there was a war going on at the time. And, you know, there was an army military barracks around the corner from my house, and there was a sergeant in that barracks. Now, him and I actually became on a friendly basis. Well, I wouldn't say it was friendly, but we actually became on a first-name basis. He started to see my behavior on the streets of Belfast. I became a fighter, guys. I was an angry, violent drunk. I became someone who just, you know, I would say out of all the times that I drank, I would say 75% or 80% of the times, guys, I got into some kind of fight or some kind of mischief, you know? I had a long list of amends when I came back here. I didn't disappoint people, guys. You know, when I'm sitting listening to my guys' amends and stuff when we're getting ready to go out and make them, I think, well, did they disappoint them there? Or, you know, I ripped my parents' hearts out of their chests. That's what I done, to the point where there's many things that brought me here, guys. There really is. There's many things I done. There's many stupid things I done. There's many hideous things I done. There's many shameful things I done. But I think one of the things that brought me here the most was standing watching my father crying in front of me. After working hard his whole life, He'd found out what I'd been doing, guys, and over a period of 2-3 years, closer to 3 years actually, I'd been stealing checks from him. Every time I'd go into the house, I was stealing checks from his checkbook, and I'd be writing checks and getting them cashed for thousands and thousands of dollars to the point where he didn't really have much money left. And his bank manager tipped onto it and called him up, and he found out it was me. And I remember leaving his house that day and looking back at him, and he's crying. And he looked me square in the face and he said, "I don't know how you could do this to me after what I've done for you and everything this family's done for you." And I'll tell you what, guys, I don't care what you're putting up your nose or what you're drinking or whatever. I heard that, and it wasn't enough to stop me drinking. And I continued on living this wild life. I really did, you know. I tried the geographical moves, everything. I tried to run away. I tried to get a girl. Isn't it funny how alcoholism works? How the mind works, it tells you, if you get one more thing, that'll make you happy. You know, if you get that job and stay in it, that will make you happy and that will be the answer. If you get that one more thing, it's never here and now in this moment. It's one more thing. And I'll tell you guys, see when problem drinking turns into alcoholism? You got problems when you're drinking, you got just as big problems when you're not drinking. And that's what started to happen to me, guys. I'd waken up in the mornings full of guilt, shame, and remorse with the shakes, swearing to myself. Clearly swearing to myself, looking in the mirror, today's the day I'm going to get sober, I'm not going to do this again. And then like an idiot, half hour later, guys, I'd be drunk again, doing it all over again. That's the powerlessness of this thing, swearing to myself, lying to myself, deceiving myself, that I'm. This is it, you know. I moved to America, so I did in the 90s. I come over here, I had an older brother that lived here, my father spoke to him and said, maybe if you get him out of this mess that he's in, bring him over here, get him a job, get him up on his feet. Maybe it's going to kick him into gear. And I come over here, guys. I come over to play football in New York. And I'll tell you, I didn't get along too well with the coaches over here because they wanted me to play sober. I don't play too well when I'm sober. And you know what, guys? That was one of the most embarrassing moments in my life. Coming to New York, saying goodbye to everyone. People were giving me money, wishing me the best, everything. 3 months later, guys, I was back in Belfast with not a dollar in my pocket and a bag full of dirty laundry. Because that's what happens to me, guys. Had to borrow the money to get back home. The exact same thing happened when I moved to London. Had to borrow the money from my sister to get back home. See, I can't survive. I can't take care of myself. I really can't. I'm not equipped spiritually to live out there sober, and I'm definitely not equipped spiritually to live out there drunk. I'm not a person who can drink safely. I've got that part down. I can never use alcohol safely, because when I use alcohol, I don't know what's going to happen. I really don't. You know what, guys? The shame and the guilt and the remorse, it builds up, so it does, you know? But you can find ways to weave and bob yourself around that. There's one thing that I could never escape from, guys, was the resentments and the fears. I really couldn't. When you'd wake up in that habitual thinking of fear, it's one worry after another. Oh, my God, what did I do last night? What am I going to do with my life? The story never ends, you know? And you got to drink. You got to drink to get rid of it. I could never cut that off, guys. Came to a point in time when the booze wouldn't even cut it off either. It really wouldn't. And I'm someone who's had suicidal tendencies from as far back as I can remember, guys. I'm someone who was trying to finish it all before I really started drinking. This soul sickness, guys, that kind of called alcoholism, it kind of chips and chaps at me and ebbs its way through me. And our book talks about my main problem centers in my mind, and I totally agree with that 100%. It centers in my mind, but it's not where it starts. There's a lot of trains that center in Grand Central Station, but that's not where they come from. See, my real problem comes from the depths of my soul, and it comes in many different shapes and forms. And it runs up this conduit inside of me, and it seems to tap into my mind and click off all these different obsessions. And what's funny is, guys, I swear to myself that I'm not going to drink and I'm not going to do it. And I'll swear to people that I'm not going to do it, and I'll tell my boss that I'm not going to do it. And, you know, I'll even give my money to people and stuff so I won't do it. You know, and I'll lock myself in places and, you know, I'll do whatever it takes, and I swear that I'm not going to do it. But something comes over me, guys, where my mind starts working on me. And see, before the obsession for me to drink returns, there seems to be a search for freedom. That I just need to squeeze some freedom out of something. So it feels like there's oxygen in the room again for me to breathe, because that's what it feels like before I go drinking. And when I get that first pop into me, guys, I feel a little bit better, and it starts to loosen this up, and this soul sickness doesn't seem to be coming through me so much. I'd have been better just walking into the bar and asking for a pint of effect, because that's what I was drinking for. Give me a pint of effect. I'll tell you guys, here's how I look at my life when I was drinking. I just felt like I was four drinks short of normality. That's what I felt like, because when I had four drinks, I felt normal. I felt I could look you straight in the face and have a conversation with you about anything. I can, when I'm that drunk, guys, when I'm that drinking, I can't do that. It just looks mundane. You see, the number one form of relapse for an alcoholic is sobriety. See, it sounds funny. It really does, because it doesn't. But that's my problem, guys, sobriety. I can't find a way long enough to survive in sobriety. I really can't. Sobriety is great. It's fantastic. And then it's good. And then it's okay. And then it's kind of mundane. And then I'm kind of tapping my feet. And then I kind of need to get out, because I don't like it. I don't like what my mind's telling me. I don't like how I'm feeling. I just don't seem to be able to tap into a kind of power that can keep me going without me getting in trouble. And then I drink again. And this went on and on and on, guys. And I'll tell you, I was a blackout drinker. I come out of blackouts in the weirdest spots that you've ever seen in your life. Let's see. On a boat on the way to Scotland. Reversing my boss's truck off a cliff that hit a wall. And the only thing that stopped me from going 200 feet into the Atlantic Ocean was the wall. You know, these are the places where I come out of these blackouts. I come out of blackouts in a lot of fights, guys, where maybe like 10, 12 people. I come out of blackouts in the emergency room. These are the places where I'd hit, you know, where my head busted open, not knowing how I got there. Those things will bring you to Alcoholics Anonymous. They really will. Those things will start to create the short form of our third tradition, the desire to stop drinking. I had the desire to stop drinking for years. For years. It wasn't enough to stop me from drinking. Those things will bring you to Alcoholics Anonymous. Getting 40, 50 staples in your head will bring you to Alcoholics Anonymous. Coming out of a blackout, throwing a petrol bomb, getting shot by the British Army will bring you to Alcoholics Anonymous. But you see, you start to get the stitches out and you start to get the staples out. And you start to feel a little bit better, you know. And then you get a little bit of time in the hospital and you're getting some attention and you're resting your nerves in there and you're shooting you up with some stuff and you start to plan it again. It's funny how the ego works, isn't it? It's the last thing to go and the first thing to return. The last thing to go and the first thing to return. And I'm landing in that hospital and I'm planning it again and I'm not even aware that I'm planning it. And off I go again. And it's going to be different this time. And sometimes it is different, guys, for a wee while. And then off I go again. I'll tell you, one of the darkest moments of my life, guys, was coming home off the back of one of those runs where I just can't get drunk anymore, guys. It's pathetic. It really is. I'm depressed. I mean, it's a dark depression. I've been thinking about offing myself for a while, and I can't do it. I really can't. I can't build up the courage. But this night, I had enough alcohol in me to go home and find the biggest bottle of pills that I could find, guys, and I started chugging them down. And I remember waking up the next time I woke up, guys, was the next morning where my grandmother was shaking me and she's punching me. And I remember, guys, it's the funniest feeling I've ever had in my life. I'd been lying there for quite a few hours. The alcohol had wore off me, but the drugs that I'd taken had started to kick into effect, and my reflexes and everything had gone, and I couldn't hold anything up. And I'm trying to edge my way across the floor, and I can see my grandmother screaming. And I remember thinking to myself, wow, I'm going to die today. I'm actually going to die. And that's a strange feeling. It really is. I had many near-death experiences, maybe half a dozen to 10 a year, you know. Psychotic episode after, and that was a strange feeling. And I remember waking up in a psych ward day or two later, guys, after being pumped and stuff, and thinking to myself, wow, what is wrong with me? What is wrong with me? You know, couldn't figure it out. Didn't know what was wrong with me, guys. All I knew that my life sucked, and if this is living, I'm not interested. I'm really not. But it's such a cruel thing, guys. You just can't, there's no backing out of it. There's no way out of it. I've been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't seem to get what you people are saying. I don't like yous. I really don't. I come in and I'm sitting at the back and, you know, I've got my hat on and I don't want anybody to come near me. I don't want anybody to look at me. I can't have a conversation with you. I really can't if I'm not drinking. And this is back in Ireland, guys. I mean, meetings are a lot different back there. And Philomena's sitting up front, and she's putting her hand up, and she's telling everybody how grateful she is. She's found God, and I just wish she'd find her teeth and put them in. You know? these weird guys are coming over to me after the meeting. They're coming over to me after the meeting, and I'm wondering why 5 and 6 guys are offering me cards to go for coffee. Guys don't go for coffee together, you know? And I'm wondering why they're doing this. And what I'm doing is, guys, my illness is just taking me right back out of Alcoholics Anonymous again. And this went on and on and on, guys. I found a way to drink for another three years after that, relapsing in there to Alcoholics Anonymous to the point in time, guys, where I committed another one of those blackouts and I couldn't take it anymore. I really couldn't. Coming out of this blackout scared me for some reason. There was a man standing in front of me covered in blood and a woman screaming. I didn't know what had done. And I remember thinking in that moment, this is going to stop. It's not going to happen again. It's really not. And I remember going for another drink after that. And going in the after hours. And thinking to myself, I'm going to do this. Because what happens when you come, what happened to me, should I say, when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous repeatedly, you can't help but think about Alcoholics Anonymous. Especially when you're drinking. And I'll tell you, a head full of AA and a belly full of booze is not a good place to be. It's really not. And I remember saying to myself, I'm going to do this. And the next day I went home. And I went back. I'm 26. I'm living in my parents' house in the front room. And I remember going in and lying down there. I'm waking up a couple of hours later and thinking to myself, I'm definitely going to do this. I just felt that something had changed. And I remember getting on my knees and asking God, a God that I was afraid to believe in, guys. But it was a God that I was afraid not to believe in. I thought, you know what, if they want me to believe in God in this place, I don't think that's a big deal. I don't think it's a lot to ask for if it's going to change my life. And I remember asking God for help if he was there. And going back to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous the next night. Not even telling anybody or anything and thinking to myself, you know what, I'm going to do what these people ask me to do. I have no other way out. My scorecard truly did read 0. And I remember going back in there, guys, with my ears open. Very afraid. Very afraid. I don't know what's in front of me, but I got nowhere else to go. I think that was my bottom. I knew that no relationship was going to fix me. No amount of money was going to fix me. Driven by 100 forms of fear like our book talks about. And I met a gentleman that changed my life, guys. It was my light bulb moment in Alcoholics Anonymous, just the way Bill Wilson had with Dr. Bob sitting in the Henrietta Cyberlands Gate Lodge. Just another man, guys, who was sick himself, who was looking for another guy to work with, stumbled across me and he seen what was going on. I mean, how can he not tell him? I got a couple of black eyes, guys, and I have a beard grown because there's tarmac, or there's asphalt burns right down my face, guys, from the last drink, because that's where I drank. That's where I drank. I was a dangerous person, psychotic person when I drank. People got hurt when I drank. I got hurt when I drank. And he knows I'm new, and he comes up to me, and he starts talking to me. And he done for me that night, guys, I'll tell you, that changed my life forever. And he opened the gates of hell, and he said, come on out, son. It's time to come out to the world and start living. And he started to 12-step me. Because I didn't know I was alcoholic. I really didn't. And he started to explain to me about this allergy. He kept asking me questions like, so what happens when you drink? And I'd be like, hold on a second. Can we talk about that in a minute? Let me tell you what's going on in my life. You know? I mean, the worst thing you could have done to me, guys, when I first came around was ask me how I was doing. It would have took me 45 minutes just to set it up to tell you how I was doing. Because I got all these problems going on. And he would just keep asking me these questions. And he would say, yeah, that's the physical allergy. And I'm like, is that what that is? And the light bulb went off that night, guys, and two things happened. It scared the life out of me because I grasped the concept that I'm actually alcoholic. And that scared me. That really did. I fell into the why me for a little bit. But then the what do I have to do came. And the answer was, I don't know, buddy, but I can show you what I've done. And I embarked on my first journey through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what's really funny? I've watched a lot of people come and go in my time in Alcoholics Anonymous, as I'm sure anybody in here that's been around for a while. But you know one thing that I've noticed? See, people that don't do all of this, they got all kinds of problems in their life. They get spending problems, eating problems, sex problems. Some of them end up with drinking problems again, you know? But what I've started to see, and I've been around long enough to see this, see the people that do all of it, they're still here and their lives are pretty good. And what I mean by all of it is this, all three sides of that triangle. That man back in Ireland, guys, he set me on fire, so he did with this thing. I mean, he really set me on fire with it. This was a man that was on fire with his own recovery, his own sobriety. He invited me into his family. I watched him around his kids. I watched him around his wife. He was a businessman who built a business, but had came from a scrap heap just like me. That impressed me. It really did. He knew my language. No one had ever been able to talk to me the way he spoke to me. He touched that little uncomfortable, dirty place inside of me that I was afraid. I couldn't communicate that with anyone. I couldn't communicate it with doctors. I couldn't communicate it with priests. I couldn't. He got me in 10 minutes. One alcoholic talking to another, properly armed with the facts about himself, can win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a matter of a couple of hours. He'd done it in 10 minutes. I just wanted to grab onto his shirt tails and follow him around, and that's what I'd done. And if you're new, you're struggling, or you're just back from a relapse or whatever, listen to people around here. Get close to someone who sounds like they know what they're doing, who seems to be working through their problems in their life, and follow them around and do what they ask you to do. See what happens. And that's what I started to do with this gentleman. You know? This is a refinement process, guys. It really doesn't have much to do with drinking, unless you're drinking. It really doesn't. When I came in the Alcoholics Anonymous, guys, I cursed everybody in AA because I thought I just had a problem with alcohol, and if I could stay away from the alcohol, I'd be okay. But the longer I stayed away from the alcohol, the more it seemed like I wasn't okay, because I got this thing called alcoholism, which really doesn't have much to do with drinking unless you're drinking. And all these things started to come up to the surface that have been bugging me for years, these resentments, guys. I didn't even know what resentment was when I came around here till a friend asked me one night on the phone, how are you doing? I said, I'm doing pretty well. But my mother is this, and that guy that I'm working with, he's an asshole. He goes, oh, dude, you're not doing well at all. That's resentment. And I'm like, oh, is that what that is? I got tons of that. And he goes, oh, I know you do. I know you do. You know? These are the things that were keeping me sick, and this man sat down with me and started to explain this stuff to me. I'll tell you guys, if anything happened the first time I went through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the obsession to drink got removed, but I'll tell you what really did happen. There was an obsession to seek this way of life in here that started to emerge. I became a seeker in Alcoholics Anonymous, guys. And I'll tell you, the second day after I met that man, I got on my knees with him at his house and took the third step at his house. And I'll tell you, I don't think there's been anything more important that I've done. Because from that moment I'd done that with him, my whole life changed, and I didn't see it at the time. It was like a spiritual explosion took place. You can't see it, you can't hear it, you can't even feel it, guys. But it's almost like when I made that decision, God set those turbines in motion and they started spinning. And things started to happen pretty fast. They really did. I got that first inventory done, and I started barking through these amends. Within my first year of sobriety, I was back living in New York. So I was sponsoring guys. I became the secretary of the group, ended up starting a group. Things started to move quick, guys. I started to get my life back bit by bit. That's what happens in here. It really does. My priorities were recalibrated. What once was important to me, it just wasn't important to me anymore. I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous, guys. And as a result of falling in love with Alcoholics Anonymous, I started to love the things that I should have been loving my whole life anyway. And I started to get to put those things right. Like I said, guys, I had so many amends, I was afraid of even looking at some of them. I really was. Got to put that right with my father. That took time. Got to put things right with my mother. That took time. I'll tell you, guys, I was living in New York. I started to make these amends. I started to pay the money back. And see, when you start doing that, it's a kind universe. You ever notice the people that are sitting whining and moaning in meetings about they don't have the right car, or you know they don't have the right job or whatever? You ever pull them to the side and ask them, how are you doing with your financial amends? Have you made them all? All of them? Have you paid back the IRS? Everybody? Because normally the guys that I talk to that do that, they don't really seem to have financial problems. They mightn't have money, but they have material well-being. And that's what I started to develop in here. And I started to pay my dad his money back. And he was a little bit queasy with me for a while, so he was. And then I started to pay this money back. And thank God for good sponsorship, guys, because every time I'd go back to Ireland, my sponsor would tell me, give your father more money. And I would say, he doesn't want any more. Give him it anyway. Did you call him up this week? I call my father 3 times a week. And he started to take heed and he started to take notice. Then I brought my mom and dad out to New York. And then I would fly home because that was part of my amends, that they wanted to see their son. And I would come home, and I'll tell you guys, one of those times, my father would pick me up at the airport and he would bring me back to the airport. And one of those times he was bringing me back to the airport. And Irishmen don't cry, guys, believe me, not like my dad. He's an old-fashioned Irishman. I watched him welling up with tears when we were driving back to the airport. And we had a moment together in the car because I knew why he was crying. And he got out of the car and he walked around and he put my kiss beside me and he hugged me and he kissed me straight in the lips. And he says, you know what, I'm very proud of you. I really am. And a short while after that, I had a phone call with him. And he told me that my cousin wasn't doing well through this illness. And he wondered, was there anything that I could do to help him? And I know my cousin and I know there's nothing I can do to help him. But he said, you know, son, I'm 75 years of age, and I've been around this world. My father was a sailor. I've been around this world, and I've seen many things in my life. He says, but I ain't never seen anything like what I've seen you change in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was nice. It's one of the greatest things that's ever been said to me, guys. It really is, because all I ever wanted was my father to love me and respect me, and I just didn't know how to do that. But you've taught me how to do that in here in Alcoholics Anonymous. All he ever wants to talk about today is AA. I'm at home, the book's on a shelf, he's been reading it. You know? He's asking all kinds of questions about it. I've got to do some good work in here, guys. I really have. I'll tell you, I was back in Ireland at Christmas, sir. And it's funny how the universe works, guys. I've been really working hard on my amends over the last 13 years to get clean. Because the men that have walked on this path in front of me told me that that's really important. We put a lot of emphasis on the fourth and fifth step and stuff. I put a lot of emphasis on it all, but especially amends. Especially amends. And I was back there, guys, and I had a bit of a qualm with the government back in Ireland over a period of 8 or 10 years, guys. I've done a lot of fraudulent activity with them, stuff that accumulated a lot of money. And the first time I went through the steps, guys, I went to their main office and they wouldn't see me, they wouldn't talk to me because of the political climate back in Ireland. And I thought, nice, I'm kind of getting off with this. And then I went through the steps again and I wrote them a letter and they never replied to it. And I thought, well, you know, I guess I'll just let bygones be bygones. But you want to know something, guys? See, when you don't clean it up, it eats away at your soul. And it cuts into all other areas of your life and you have problems. And I went back at Christmas, guys. And I get back there on a Monday morning, and the Sunday newspaper was sitting on the arm of my mother's chair. And I don't read newspapers, guys. I got enough garbage in my head. I don't watch the news either. You know, you feed your man garbage, guess what it's going to feed you back is garbage. But I thought, let me take a look and see what's going on around this place that I used to terrorize. And one of the big gangsters back there, so-called big gangsters, I seen his picture in the paper, and I'm reading, what did he do? And lo and behold, he just got a prison sentence, a custodial sentence for doing exactly the same thing that I'd been doing and hadn't cleaned up. And I thought, nice, this is going to be a nice Christmas, you know? And then the ego starts to do its work. And I wasn't really afraid, guys. And I called up my sponsor and he said, all right, well, you got to do some detective work. We become great detectives in Alcoholics Anonymous, don't we? And you got to find out what's going on. Find out if you can get a number or anything. And I found a number for the new government building. And he says, well, you got to call it up and tell them what you've done. And I called it up, and I had a government official on the other end of the phone, guys. And I told him what I'd done. And he said, hold on a minute. You're admitting to fraud? I said, yeah, I guess that's what I am doing. I said, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just want to clean it up. And he said, wow, I've never heard anything like this in my life before. And I said, I bet you haven't, you know. Neither's most of the people in AA. And he said, well, I think you might have to give us it in writing. And I said, well, I've already given it to you in writing. And I've already been to your main office and you wouldn't see me. And we were on the phone for quite a while. And he didn't know what to do. And I said, whatever you ask me to do, I'm willing to do it. And he sat quiet for a while and he said, I think you should go back to that Alcoholics Anonymous and put your mind at rest, son. And this is forgotten about. And I never thought too much about it. I thought, okay, cool. I was willing to go to jail. I really was. And I called my sponsor up, and he said, wow. He says, isn't that funny? He said, you're willing to put everything on the line and go to prison for what you found in Alcoholics Anonymous. See, that's what I have found in here, guys. Something magical. I'm willing to do that. You want to know why? Because see, the God that I found in here, wherever I go, God is. Wherever I go, he is. And there hasn't been one moment in over 13 years in Alcoholics Anonymous where I've been that God hasn't been with me. Now, that's a choice right there. I can either choose that he's with me or choose that he's not with me. And for most of the time I've choose for him to be with me, there's a lot of times I haven't. And I've paid the price for it. I really have. But I think that something has been developed through me. I got to tell you guys, I haven't done no work in here. I really haven't. No sponsor's done any work with me either. I don't think we even have the power to do the work. What I do is I make myself available to this material, and the work is done through me by the universe. See, God gave me this kit of simple spiritual tools. Simple spiritual tools, right? Meetings, book, sponsor, all that stuff. See, he gave me that little kit of spiritual tools for me to play with and keep me occupied, because he's got the big kit of spiritual tools where he does all the hammering and the fixing. I don't have to fix anything in here. All I have to do is show up. That's why I was excited to come here tonight, because I get to show up again. I've never seen anybody relapse out of this program. Not one person. Isn't that amazing? You're probably thinking, he must be blind. I've only ever seen people relapse out of the fellowship. Because it talks about in the chapter how it works. There's people who can that or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. I've worked with a lot of guys. I've only ever met will nets. I've never met a can that. I've only ever met will nets. I can't make it tonight, but why? I've got to go to church. You haven't been to church in 10 years? Yeah, but I got to go tonight. what about your fourth step? I've only ever met will nets. And here's why they're will nets. Say you get a guy, and I'm going to finish on this. Say you get a guy that comes up to you in a detox or a treatment center or a rehab or outside a meeting, and he says to you, will you sponsor me? And you say yes. Here's the deal. See, if you call me every day for the next while, and you come and meet me at my house once, twice, three times a week, whatever it takes to go through this book, because that's how I do it, and you get a home group and you get a job in that group, and you start calling me and you start doing these things, and say over the next 2-3 months, if you do that, see, at the end of it, there's going to be $1 million for you. Could you imagine how that would go? Adrian, come on, man. You got to give me the direction on those amends. Come on, hurry up, man. Why? Because you see, you're laughing because for $1 million, you'd do it, right? So that's a will net. We're will nets. So we are. I got to tell you, see, if you're new, you're struggling, and you're really knuckled down, you get up on your feet and you start to walk on this path, it's way better than any $1 million. Because what happens is, you get up on your feet and you start walking on this path, and you follow the clear-cut directions, the blueprints that have left our co-founders and our early members left for us. You start to walk on this path, the path will start walking you. It'll start walking you. That's been my experience, it really is. The obsession to drink, it's gone. You know what? I fall into a category of people that die drunk. I don't know if there's another drink down the path for me. I really don't. You know what? I don't waste my time worrying about it or thinking about it. God's developed such a relationship with me because I've let him. This has been a refinement process. Things have been stripped away. Things have been taken away. The more that's taken away, these resentments, these fears, the closer you get to God. And I'll tell you, see, if this is as close I ever get to God, it's pretty damn close for a drunk like me. Thanks for having me.
For a home group member.
Yes, my name is Jeff Nalcoff.
Hey, Jeff.
I am eternally grateful for this group and program of Alcoholics Anonymous and God that I've come to understand in this program somewhat, much more than I did before I got here. And I've experienced more love in this program in the last 7 years that I've been doing this than I've probably experienced all my life. And the majority of that is from you guys and from people that I sponsor. And I'm very, very honored to give this coin to Shelly, who asked me just simply to show her what was shown to me. And I did that as per my sponsor's request. When he took me through the work, he said, listen, I'm just going to show you what was shown to me in hopes that you're going to do that for some other people. And I said, okay, I will do that to the best of my ability. And that's really what's happened. I've just simply been simply just been giving away what was freely given to me. And when I went through this with Shelly, she absolutely was willing to do what was required, do what was asked of the directions in the book, and then share that with other people, and she does that. And as a result, her and I have gotten to share that love with many other people in Alcoholics Anonymous and out there in the real world. And I see her doing it on a consistent basis. And I'm at a loss for words, really, other than that it's just a great honor. And if anybody has missed out on that, you're missing out on what is really what this program is all about, which is freely giving away what was given to us. I think that's all I got. I'm just really grateful. And
I'm full of love, thinking of the God thing through me, and I'm grateful for this group particularly, because for 9 years I didn't do the work and suffered the consequences, and I thank God I didn't have to go out and drink before I got on my knees and asked for help and did the work, and life has been amazingly different, and I've been led to a God and cleared the wreckage away, getting closer to this God, and it's been a heck of a journey, and I'm full of love and gratitude for sponsorship and working with others, and in Alcoholics Anonymous, the book, and the program, and the founders, and so thanks. So I'm chairing, too. And we're going to have Rich share about the history of the group for a couple minutes before we have delicious homemade cake.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Rich, and I am an alcoholic. I have been working on this history of this group for a better part of, like, 2 years. I just kind of wanted to go over some of the people who paved the path for me, if you will, and what got us to... when this group started back in 06, I tried writing this on the computer this afternoon, but my buddy who I live with has changed the format on the Word, so this is really bad. Anyway, somewhere in the Baltimore area, back in the 60s or 70s, I don't know his sobriety date, there was this Zen truck driver who had like a fifth grade education. His name was Wally. And along came this hot-headed businessman by the name of Tom Flynn in August of 1980. And Tom met Wally, and Tom got sober and stayed sober. And then this ex-Navy pilot, Steve F., showed up in Baltimore, hadn't had a drink in about 6 or 7 years and was dying from untreated alcoholism. He met Tom and went through the work and got a reprieve. And Tom and Steve worked together for quite some time. And in 96, summer of 1996, they formed a group called the Harbor City Speakers Group and ran with that for a while. This is kind of cool. Steve then, Steve, who was from Boston originally, caught wind of a snorted up, drunken, psycho, soon-to-be ex-lawyer friend in Boston who needed help. And Steve just happened to be heading up into New England and picked up this man and they took a trip around New England and went through some step work. And Dave Perry got sober in 2001. Great year. Anyway, about a year later, Steve headed back up to Boston to celebrate Dave's one-year anniversary and runs into this totally psycho, cranked-up, drunk, roaming the streets of Boston by the name of Greg Howard. And Greg managed to get through the work with Steve Farnsworth and got sober and moved back to York, where Steve was living at the time. These dates might not be very specifically accurate, but they're close enough. Greg started doing what Greg did, and he did a great job out in New York. He moved to Philly eventually, and then eventually got a job up here in Regalsville, and moved there and started doing his deal in the Quakertown and Percocet area, where somewhere around 03, maybe early 04, ran into a young contractor who had been sober a handful of years, who was dying from untreated alcoholism. This gentleman got together with Greg Howard and had his reprieve. His name was Chris. This is kind of a cool part. They were hanging around the Quakertown, Percocet area in April of 05. This extremely angry, untreated tree man shows up in Quakertown in the basement of a church, and that'd be myself. And I met Greg, heard Greg's story, asked Greg if he would help me, and he did, and I got my reprieve. And we started doing a deal in Quakertown, and Chris and Greg got together one night and said, we got to start a meeting, and they talked to Steve, and they found a church, and on the 27th of March, 2006, this group was born. And it's kind of neat that I'm still here. I think that's totally amazing. And I'm, so many people have come into the path of this group. Bob, I'm going to miss some names. Sarah, just a bunch of beautiful people throughout the course of these 8 years have come and helped this meeting to grow. And I have just seen hundreds and hundreds of people come here, find a sponsor, do the work, get sober, stay sober, and help others to do the same. I can't thank Adrian enough for coming out tonight. Awesome message as always. We've had roughly 415 speakers here since 2006, which is kind of cool. None of them were fired or sent home early. And that's pretty much in a nutshell how Feet First started. I'm glad you were all here tonight. I'm glad that everyone who has come here through the course of the past 8 years, Rhubarb been hanging around a while. It's just been a wonderful experience, and I hope you people keep coming back and this thing continues to grow. Thanks.